So Avalokiteshvara has been somebody who's been at the very beginning of my journey. So I wanted to start by telling one of the legends of Avalokiteshvara. So I'll ask them to do this. Many aeons ago, in the land of Tibet, the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, was so moved by the suffering of the people in this land. He was so moved that he decided to make a vow. Now, when you make a vow, it's said that you should never, ever break a vow. But Avalokiteshvara was determined that he would not take enlightenment until all the people of Tibet was removed from suffering. And so he made this vow in front of his teacher, Amitabha, the Red Buddha of the West. Amitabha, I vow to establish all living beings to happiness. I vow that no living being will have suffering. I vow that I will not choose my own happiness and peace in exchange for all those beings' happiness and peace. And I will never waver from this vow. And if I do, may I explode into a million pieces. And Amitabha accepted this vow because, as a bodhisattva, it's said you shouldn't take full enlightenment until all beings have been relieved of suffering. And so Avalokiteshvara went among the people teaching his mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, radiating compassion as he went about Tibet, telling the people what the mantra meant. He told them, when you chant you can feel that you are transforming your pride and selfishness and cultivating generosity. He told them, when you chant ma, you can feel you are transforming your jealousies and cultivating an ethical life. He told them, when you chant ni, you can feel you are transforming your craving and cultivating patience. He told them, when you chant pad, you can feel that you are transforming your ignorance and prejudices and cultivating diligence. He told them, when you chant may, you can feel that you are transforming your possessiveness and cultivating letting go of attachments. He told them, when you chant hum, you can feel that you are transforming your hatred and aggression and cultivating wisdom. And so the people of Tibet went about reciting the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, 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 holding in their hearts the meanings of each syllable. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. And Avalokiteshvara felt that this was now the time for him to enter into deep meditation. And so he went into deep samadhi with the vow in his heart. And he sat for weeks and weeks and weeks. And at some point, he emerged from deep meditation and looked over the land of Tibet. Not even 100 of the people have benefited from my efforts. No one, hardly anyone, has been relieved of their suffering. What use is it for me to practice? Maybe I should just take my own peace and happiness. Amitabha and Avalokiteshvara exploded into 1,000 pieces, and Amitabha, with great compassion, came to Avalokiteshvara's aid, and he said, Avalokiteshvara, I will give you 11 heads. The first head will be for Sila. The second head will be for wisdom. The third head will be for energy. The fourth head will be for renunciation. The fifth head will be for truthfulness. The sixth head for determination. The seventh head for equanimity. The eighth head for loving kindness. The ninth head for generosity. The tenth head for patience. And I will place my own head on top of your 10 heads so that you will be all-seeing, so that you can radiate boundless compassion in all directions. And I will give you 1,000 arms, and in each arm there will be an implement to help you relieve the suffering of all the people in Tibet. Some legends say that when Avalokiteshvara was put back together again, that he looked over the land of Tibet, and for the first time he saw so clearly the extent of the work it would take to relieve all these people of their suffering. And in that moment of that realization, a tear dropped from his eye, forming a lake. And from that lake, a lotus bud grew. And on that lotus bud, green Tara emerged. And so both Avalokiteshvara and green Tara stepped out into the world, helping as many people as possible to relieve them from their suffering. Avalokiteshvara comes in many forms. One of my favourite forms is the royal ease form, often known as Kuan Yin. Kuan Yin is female, and Kuan Yin is the female version of Avalokiteshvara in China. And there's something about this posture that has always moved me. There is also a four-armed Avalokiteshvara. In fact, I should pass them around so that you can see them more clearly. And sometimes you may hear Shenrig, which is a form of Avalokiteshvara. Sometimes you may hear Lokeshvara, which is another form of Avalokiteshvara or Kuan Yin. And all of them gaze down on the people with great compassion. It's often said that they hearken to the cries of the suffering. But the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara is really important to the Triratna Buddhist community, if you'd like to pass it around. The thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara is a symbol of the Triratna order, which I'm part of and which many of us here in this room are part of. And I like to feel that actually the thousand arms represent what some of the order members do out there in the world. The order members like Bodhi Leela, Ratnaprabha, Kamalashila, who are part of this centre here, being of service to the public. Some of you may have heard of Vidyamala, who has set up Breathworks to work with people in pain. That is an arm of Avalokiteshvara in action. The work I do in recovery is another arm of Avalokiteshvara in action.
And for those of us who are order members, we actually took the Bodhisattva vow when we were ordained. And for me, I take that almost quite literally. Regularly, I recite, may I relieve all beings from suffering. May I conquer all passions. May I master all dharmas. May I lead all beings to Buddhahood. It's very, very important to me. And as I said earlier, that Avalokiteshvara has somebody who's been on my journey from very early on. I remember maybe 20 years ago or more, and I went on a solitary. And I was in this place where there was this tunnel, a small tunnel, but one of those tunnels that echo. And I was reciting the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. And I could feel the arms of Avalokiteshvara embracing me. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. And it was the first time that I really got in touch with some tears, with some feeling. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. And this was the moment when I really connected to Avalokiteshvara, to the compassion, because one thing that I really needed to learn for myself was to have compassion for myself. I had to learn to have compassion for myself before I could have compassion for others. And Avalokiteshvara has journeyed with me, but actually, interestingly, when we are ordained, we take on a visualization practice. And the visualization practice that I took on was Kuan Yin. So I took on Avalokiteshvara in a female form. But it feels quite strange talking about male form and female form, because, you know, as we know, nothing's binary. It's all on a continuum. And actually, Bodhisattvas are genderless. They are genderless. But I took on the practice of Kuan Yin. And Kuan Yin has really travelled with me. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I was teaching the four reminders. The first reminder is precious birth, recognizing we have this precious birth. And that was another aspect of me really connecting to having compassion towards myself. And as I was teaching this precious birth, I said to people, okay, go away and reflect on your precious birth for a week. And so, of course, if I asked people to do this, it was an opportunity, again, for me to really reflect on my precious birth. And I realized that when I was reflecting on it, that actually I only really understood it on an intellectual level. And I realized that I really, on an experiential level, on an emotional level, that I didn't really quite understand why this birth is precious. I knew on an intellectual level it's precious because, you know, few eggs survive, so it's quite a miracle all of us sitting here, because many of those eggs do, the majority of them die. So it is a miracle that we're here. But I just knew that wasn't enough. And so I decided to ask myself the question, if my birth is precious, why do I want to live? And every answer that I had was quite ego-based. It was, I wanted to live because I still had lots of things to do, you know, wasn't ready to die, and I don't know, maybe people might miss me, So I flipped it the other way and thought, well, if my birth is precious, why don't I want to die? But still these ego-based answers kept on arising. And the problem was I was trying to approach this reflection from the intellect, which is why I wasn't getting very far. So I just had to let it go. And I don't know whether it was 2 months later or 3 months later, but I just remember this voice emerging, just saying, there was something about the preciousness of birth. I can't remember exactly again, it's an idea. But there was this voice, the preciousness of birth. And then I heard this voice of, what you have to offer is your recovery. And I went, oh, I don't want to hear that. I'm not interested in that. And I turned away from it. It was uncomfortable. But I knew I had to turn towards it. And it was the most compassionate thing to do. So I did, a few days later, I turned towards it. What did it mean? What did that mean? I had my recovery to offer. So I got curious about it. And in that curiosity, I met another bodhisattva, Shitigarbha. And Shitigarbha is the bodhisattva that dwells in the hell realms, that rescues people from their misery in the hell realms. And in a way, if I think of people who are suffering with addictions, it is a hell realm. I know for myself, when I was in the throes of my addiction, I talk about the hell of my addiction. And so, as I say, that when I realized that actually, or I had this, my recovery to offer, Shitigarbha emerged for me. And what did that mean? Because I'd never identified with somebody being in recovery, that I'd had many other identities that I had identified with, like black, female, queer, feminist, but I hadn't identified as somebody being in recovery. And in a way, it wasn't like I just wanted to take this label that, oh, I'm in recovery. But when I reflected on it, I just thought, yeah, I do have something to offer out there in the world. And just something has really changed for me since then, since embracing that. It's as if it's given more meaning to my life. It's like I really feel that offering my recovery is stepping in the foot of the Buddha. I'm a disciple of the Buddha. And I just really feel by offering my recovery, I'm stepping in the foot of the Buddha. Because that's what Shakyamuni offered. When Shakyamuni became a Buddha, he offered his recovery. And that recovery was the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. That there's suffering, simply there's suffering. That there is a path that leads to more suffering. That there's an end of suffering. And there's a way out of suffering. The Eightfold Path. That's what he offered. He offered his recovery to the world. And I find it really interesting because coming to the book and, you know, being asked to talk about Avalokiteshvara and talk about eight-step recovery, what I find really interesting is in England, in the Buddhist community, that the Buddhist community hasn't really embraced recovery. It's something which is a bit over there, and it may be that we're a bit concerned perhaps who we might invite through our doors. But if you think about it, the Christians developed their recovery program, and that was the 12-step program. 12-step program actually came out of, it was Christians. Bill Wilson actually was very clear, or somebody advised Bill Wilson,
don't make it Christian, because actually it will isolate a lot of people. And if you want to reach as many people as possible, it's very important not to couch it within Christianity. But it came out of the Christian philosophy. And actually, there are many meetings that you can go to where the Christianity has slipped in. And when the Lord's Prayer, you can find yourself saying the Lord's Prayer, you know. And so we have a recovery program in the Buddhist tradition, you know. And it comes in many different models. The one we know is the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. But there are many, many different teachings in the Dharma that show us a way out of suffering. And so in a way, it just makes complete sense to write a book focusing on how to use the Buddhist teachings to overcome addiction. Because it makes so much sense, because addiction is unfortunately part of society. It affects all of us, you know? I mean, how many of you here in this room, raise your hand in this room if you do not know somebody who is suffering with an addiction? Raise your hand. Or if you've not heard of somebody. Exactly. So it touches all of us. I was in India in January for the whole month of January. And I was working with people from the villages, young people from the villages. And so many of the young people said, every home in India knows of addiction. Every home in India knows of addiction. And you know, for me, when I think of addiction, I don't think of the usuals of just alcohol or drugs or sex or gambling or food. You know, many of you have heard me say it, and I'll say it again. Stinking thinking is an addiction, and stinking thinking can be the cause of murder. It can be the cause of sexual abuse. It can be the cause of physical abuse. So when we think of addiction and think, oh, that's not us, take another rain check and actually think, is this about me? Of course, it's all on a continuum, but every one of us here in this room walked through the doors of a Buddhist centre because you wanted change from something. Change from your life. And part of our life is made up from our mental states. Part of our life is made up from the proliferation of thought. And so, for me, this work of recovery is very, very important. And I'm based in North America, and in North America, Buddhist recovery is really on the up. It's beginning to spread quite rapidly. We have Noah Levine, the son of Stephen Levine, if you've heard of Stephen Levine, who has actually developed a program called Refuge Recovery, which is based on the Eightfold Path, and has created a whole lineage, Dharma punks. It's called Against the Stream. And it's just, it's wonderful just to see actually the diversity in that lineage. You know, in a way, how diverse are we? The diversity of seeing guys with tattoos all over here, big biker guys, guys, you know, who've had addictions, etc. But he's created a whole lineage and Refuge Recovery. We have people like Kevin Griffin and Laura S., who come from the 12-step tradition, who have looked at 12 steps and Buddhism and how they intersect and how you can work with them
together. And then we have those here in England, Paramabandhu and I have put a book specifically looking at some of the teachings in the Buddhist tradition that we can use. And the way we see the eight steps is really an expression of the 11th step. And those of you who are familiar with the 12-step tradition will know that the 11th step is having a closer relationship with prayer and meditation. It's the spiritual aspect. And that's really important because, you know, Bill Wilson knew that the spiritual aspect to recovery is so important. In fact, he spoke about the three-legged stool. It needed to be emotional, physical, and spiritual. And so at Vancouver Buddhist Center, I run an evening called Recovery Mondays where people from 12-step tradition come, people from Smart Recovery come, people who haven't ever been in a recovery group before come. And what I say to them is that this is your 11th step. And more people from that evening are becoming mitras. And when we have those mitra ceremonies, we do it on that evening of recovery. And I say that actually this is their expression of their 11th step. So those of you who are in a 12-step program and think, how can I bring Buddhism and 12-step together? I say you can bring it together in your 11th step. How are you going to express your 11th step? You can express your 11th step through Buddhism, or you can express it through Catholicism, or you can express it through Judaism or Sufism or even Islam, whatever, you know? But this is the step where one needs to find an expression of the spiritual self. And one of the ways you can do it is through the Buddhist teachings. And I'll end it there. Thank you.
I have a question, and it's quite a personal one. Just trying to think of the right way to phrase it. So I guess where I find myself in is for many years kind of locked in a cycle. I had a serious addiction to drugs in my teenage years, and I got clean in my early 20s. But I've gone in and out of the rooms of recovery, and I don't consider myself to be... I don't consider myself to need the kind of abstinence path anymore, but what I grapple with and what I've grappled with over times is maintaining. I have a strong belief in the kind of the ethos of the steps and the ethos of the ethos of a path, but kind of finding a way to fit within that kind of paradigm for me as an individual. And I don't know if I've articulated that very well, but I guess it's a question that kind of often comes up for me. One of the ways that I meet it is through doing the group that I've been at tonight, you know, and their acceptance of me despite, or because of, maybe, you know, that... these struggles, but I don't know what the question is exactly, but I guess I'm interested in your thoughts on, because I think there are others like me who feel the need for some kind of spiritual path or, you know, some kind of route into recovery, but maybe don't identify it anymore with that kind of primary addiction that they once had.
So are you abstinent?
No, I'm not. I'm abstinent. I'm not abstinent from alcohol. I'm abstinent okay. from drugs.
Okay. And was alcohol ever an issue?
No.
Okay. I asked that question because of what you said about abstinence first.
Yeah.
The other question is the struggle like in the rooms, when I say in the 12-step rooms, often it's like, hi, I'm so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. Is that part?
It's part of that, and it's part of, do I need to kind of renounce, you know, is there a need to kind of renounce, you know, alcohol particularly? But yeah, it's a struggle to have the identity when I don't fully... And I don't fully believe that I have the identity, if that makes sense. And I can get into a tangle with it that drives me in and out.
Does are you at peace with drinking alcohol?
I don't think I am entirely. But I'm not entirely sure why I'm not at peace with it.
I mean, there's one of the things that I would say, which is quite liberating about the teachings, and one of the teachings is a non-self teaching. And in a way, it's like letting go of these identities. And so in the rooms is often, hi, I'm an addict, I'm this, and people hold very tightly to that. And some people very struggle and have different variations, like I'm a recovering addict, or, you know, some people don't say anything. And I think there's a real value of identifying with that. What comes to mind for me is the late Pat Parker, who was a African-American writer and activist. And one of the things she says is, I just really think it's an emptiness teaching. Emptiness is born, form is only emptiness. Because she says, first you remember I'm black, and second you forget I'm black. And I think you can use that in many ways. First you remember I'm an addict, and second you forget it. You know, and there's people like Adishanti who would say, who's a kind of an Advaita teacher, who would say, once you think you've got it, you've lost it. Okay, and I think that's really, really helpful. So even for me, in terms of my recovery, I remember I'm an addict, and second, I forget it. But I can't. But I don't carry that identity around with me. But I don't delude myself. I don't think, oh yes, I can, you know, I'm so far away, I can engage with particular things. And what happens is, and you'll only discover this for yourself, but what actually happens is, the more you practice and the more you train the mind, that there's a disinterest, I have a disinterest in alcohol. I wasn't an alcoholic, but I actually, you know, there was reasons why I let go of alcohol initially, partly because I was working in the field of addiction, and you had these women saying, well, it's not possible to ever stop drinking. And I thought, well, maybe I need to look at stopping drinking and see whether it's possible, which is why I let go. And then also, you know, one of the precepts is intoxicants. And I really feel like, actually, yeah, you know, that precept, it's training my mind to let go of intoxicants, you know, and alcohol is an intoxicant. Just as I want to let go of my stinking thinking, which is an intoxicant, I want to let go of the alcohol, which is an intoxicant too, you know. So, but there's a disinterest in it. But then there's a teaching, guard the sense doors. So I don't feel like, you know, my drug of choice, if I was around my drug of choice, I have a disinterest in it, but if I was hanging around it for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I'd most probably be back in it again, because one does have to guard the sense doors. But I just think it's a reflection for you in terms of what's the attachment to the alcohol? You know, there is a neurotic attachment to it. You know, what would it mean to let go of it? You know, what would that mean? Why are you holding on to it?
Are you asking me now?
I want you to just, because you can only, now you'll just answer out of conditioning or whatever, to just reflect on it. But clearly you're not at peace.
No.
So that's what I leave you with. Clearly you're not at peace and you want to come to a place of peace with it.
Of course.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. One final question before we end, if somebody has a burning question. Yeah.
In dealing with addiction, is it a never-ending path, or is there somewhere that you get to?
Is it a never-ending
path? Is it a sort of, even if you are sober for 25 years or 50 years, is it an ongoing struggle for the rest of your existence, or is there a place that you get to where you are truly at peace? And it's no longer the temptation. It just isn't a temptation.
I think it's, we can get to that place, and you know, it begins with a disinterest. I mean, you know, let's look at Shakyamuni. Shakyamuni has showed us a way out of suffering, and it is possible to come to a place of peace with it. And you know, just something like meat. I'm a vegetarian, and I've been a vegetarian for the majority of my life, but I had a bit of a lapse where I ate fish for a while, like 15 years ago back, and I can say that it was interesting how it started on, I was a vegetarian. Well, on an emotional level as a kid, I couldn't understand how people could boil lobster alive and eat rabbits when I had pet rabbits, so I'd already been kind of traumatized. But then, you know, you move on and you get on to eating meat. And then I went to university and it was just cheaper to eat. It was cheaper to eat vegetables. And then, you know, being on the women's scene, it was political. And then it changed. It's emotional, and there's a disinterest in it. In fact, I couldn't. There is a disinterest. It doesn't. And once upon a time, there was a real interest in black culture. Meat is something which is, you know, very central. You need to know how to cut that chicken up and how to clean that chicken and season it and blah blah blah. You know, so you know it is possible. Yeah, you can be liberated. That's why I'm on the path. It's, yeah. And the more you stay on the path, you will have glimpses of freedom, you know? And in a way, for me, I just stay with, you know, not to think that I've got it. You know, even with that sense with the, you know, talking about the meat or whatever, not to think that I've got it, because then you've lost it. It's not fixing something. But definitely there's freedom.
Isn't that a fundamental difference from the way AA approaches alcoholism or drug dependence? Because that doesn't AA believe that once an addict, always an addict, constant vigilance to the end of your days sort of thing? So they don't believe that you can actually finally be liberated and let go.
It's very true, but that's what's great about the Dharma, that those people who are in the 12-step tradition can take their practice even deeper. Because I know in the rooms that, you know, there are what people call dry drunks or dry addicts, that they have the abstinence, they've got the abstinence down, but they don't have sobriety of mind. And what the Dharma can give us is sobriety of mind. And when you begin to have sobriety of mind, you begin to see a different freedom.